Join us for the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society's annual conference. It's happening October 24th through the 26th in New York City. This year's theme, Rethinking Paradigms, Innovative Approaches for Optimal Wellness. And it's not just for healthcare professionals. Teachers, parents, and curious minds are invited too. We've got a phenomenal lineup of keynote speakers. Dr. Thomas Campbell, physician and co-author of The China Study, bringing insights on nutrition and lifestyle medicine. And Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, trauma expert and author of The Body Keeps the Score, who practically rewrote how we think about trauma. I'll be chatting with some of this year's speakers in upcoming episodes of Healthy Brain, Happy Body, so stay tuned to get a sneak peek and maybe even a little inspired. Find the registration link in the show notes. It's 3 days of inspiration, insight, and community you won't want to miss. Here's what Jeffrey Schultz, board member of NRBS, has to say about coming to New York City.
One of my favorite things is meeting people, talking to them, talking to other clinicians, finding out that they're struggling with things too, and then just having fun. Because the cool thing is we're not just all brainiacs. There's actually some pretty sweet people to hang out with and have a good time with. So I found friendships out of this. I found a lot of fun with this. And I'm just going to add that on top of it. Because if you're thinking about just, hey, I can get continuing education units, great. You can do that online. What you are not going to get is the experience of meeting people and making the friends. And I'm kind of old school when it comes to that. I miss the conferences. I love the seminars. Why? Because frankly, I just want to get to know more people and I want to learn from them and have a good time. So I got to tell you, one of the things you're going to get out of this, and you need to go. You don't want to just go online. You want to go to New York City because you'll have a chance to actually eyeball to eyeball, face to face. We're going to have a chance to get to meet each other and shoot the breeze, learn. It's a really good environment for that.
So join us in New York City, October 24th through the 26th. Find the registration link in the show notes or at nrbs.org. We'll see you there. Welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a podcast from the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. I'm Dr. Saul Rosenthal, a health psychologist in the Boston area, and your host as we investigate the incredible connections between brain and body. Today, we continue our conversation with Drs. Don Moss and Angel McGrady. The two have collaborated for over a decade, developing the Pathways Model for Health. This is an approach to managing chronic health conditions that integrates typical medical interventions with behavioral, cognitive, and psychophysiological approaches. They have just published their first book for a general audience, Pathways Through Long-Term Health Conditions. The Pathways Model emphasizes the role of self-efficacy in improving health. Even when we experience chronic illness, our health can often be improved when we ourselves take charge through improving diet, self-regulation, and other healthy habits. We do not only have to rely on medical intervention. In the last episode, we discussed the model and how the two developed it. In this episode, we talk about some clinical examples and working with their model in real life.
What are some of the things you've learned from your patients and the people you've worked with that have contributed to the model?
Well, one of the things I've learned is that I'm a therapist. I do biofeedback. I do hypnosis. I do heart rate variability with most of my patients. But I never know in advance what's going to touch this particular patient most to the greatest extent. And another story, I was running a pathways-oriented, lifestyle change-oriented pain management program in a hospital. And I had a lovely woman in her late 60s attending, and suddenly she was gone, and I didn't know why. I thought, oh, that's too bad. I thought she could benefit from this. And I tried to reach her, didn't reach her. But that Christmas, I received a Christmas card thanking me, and proceeded to receive Christmas cards from her for several years. She explained that the last class she attended was about social supports, and she went home and she called her sister that she hadn't been seeing. And she and the sister got together, and the sister brought a cousin along, and the three women started going to shopping together, doing other activities, quilting together, just a variety of activities. And it made such a difference for her. She said, yes, I guess I still hurt, but it doesn't matter as much. I'm so busy with my sister and my cousin that I don't have time to think about that pain. So I wouldn't have guessed that. But for her, that social breakthrough was the most important thing that she could have gotten out of our class.
Well, I think what I have learned is that people have inner strengths that they don't realize that they have. You know, we hear these stories day after day, year after year, and sometimes I listen to the story and I don't know how that person has kept going. I don't know how that person is going to leave a session with me and go to work or go home back home and take care of their kids. So one of the things that the book emphasizes, I think, is recognizing your own personal strengths and saying that's what we want to think about first. You know, how did you get to this point? How did you keep yourself going for the length of time that you've had this chronic condition? And then we build on that. And this is also a concept that I use in medical education with the medical students and the medical residents as well, is that everybody has personal strengths and then everybody has challenges. So being able to use a strength to help you to work on a challenge. So let's say that somebody is very intellectually gifted. Let's say they're cognitive, and there's examples of that in the book, that somebody may rate themselves in the cognitive assessment, you know, as a 5 out of 5. Very well educated. They catch things really smart. I mean, really quickly. They're very intelligent. They catch things very quickly. But on the other end of things, they're emotionally very reactive. You say, okay, so what are we going to do with that? Well, I would tell them, I say, well, let's use your intellectual abilities to understand the emotional reactions and therefore be able to control the emotional reactions. And I might give them a mini physiology lecture at that point so that they understand, you know, what's actually happening and they grasp that. So that, I think that's mainly what I have learned, is how strong people are and how much they can overcome.
Yeah, I think that distinction between strengths and challenges is, it often seems like it's key to working with these folks, because they come in sort of focused on their challenges and their inabilities, and even trying to get them to recognize that they have strengths is a huge challenge, at least for me, when I work with them. What sort of strategies, how would you suggest people find their own strengths? Particularly, you know, we're all stuck in our own brains. It's hard for us to step outside and see, oh, in fact, we're not as unable to meet our challenges as we think. So what are some of the ways that individuals can help themselves find their strengths?
I think that's the point of level one, is we ask the individual to come up with 2 or 3 goals, small things that are doable within their everyday life. And oftentimes, one or more of those changes will produce some feelings of what we call self-efficacy. I'm doing something and I feel better. I may only feel slightly better, but I feel better. And we keep checking back, you know, how are you doing with that? What does it feel like when you're moving to music with your daughter? Or what does it feel like when you're actually falling asleep better and wake up in the morning and you've slept more hours of the night?
I think that's also the point of the assessments, the pre pathways, a personal assessment, because they may not have thought of these things as a strength necessarily. So there's the use of risky substances, as we call it. And somebody says, oh, no, that's not me at all. I have a glass of wine, you know, once or twice a week, or I don't use any alcohol, or I don't smoke. And so we say, well, that's a real strength, because then you don't have to try to manage that. And they kind of look at you like, oh, okay, I guess so. You know, I guess so. And other things, and as I gave that example, is that you don't have to worry that you're not going to understand something. You know, that something is going to be explained to you and you're going to leave and you're going to say, I don't understand what they said, or they don't read well. And that leads to kind of something else, is that some of the folks, you know, are very good on social media. That can be a plus and a minus. But then we recommend that they skim through the whole listing of the websites that we've put at the back of the book. Because if they're really good in negotiating that, then they can find things that other people can't find.
Well, that raises another kind of question I had, which is about using the book. If I was to just go buy it in the bookstore or on Amazon, I guess these days, how would I, as a layperson, use the book? What would you recommend that I would do?
I would encourage them to read the opening chapters and then to read two or three of the case histories, and then to use section three to set some goals, because section three is basically a series of instructions and worksheets for them to start setting goals for themselves. Now, if they're in a relationship with a counselor, I would also take that book into the counselor and say, I'm using this book at home. I wish you'd read it too, because I think you could give me feedback as we go forward. Or if there's a health coach available in their community, maybe one of their friends has worked with a health coach and recommends that person. Again, I would bring the book to my health coach and say, I want you to read this and help me with it. But if they don't have access to a professional, I think the book is written in such a way that they can proceed forward themselves.
And I would agree with that, to read through the first few chapters to get an idea of what we mean by pathways. And then I would say, pick up any chapter, any of the chapters that has a case in it, because we wrote the book so that people could benefit from pretty much any of the chapters, even if they don't have the condition. So we introduced this concept of healing themes, that each chapter has a concept that's a threading right through it. So the chapter, for example, on irritable bowel syndrome, say, well, I'm not going to read that one because I don't have any GI problems. But yes, read it anyways, because it's really about embarrassment. All right. The chapter on high blood pressure doesn't give any recommendations for dosages of medicine. It doesn't give any specific recommendations on, well, you have to follow this specific diet. It's mentioned in there. But the idea of the chapter on hypertension is that the experience of a child that is very poorly understood by that child then affects that person as an adult when that person develops the same symptomatology as the men in his family have had, and that has killed them at relatively young ages. So that's what it's really about. It's not necessarily traumatic memory, because there's a chapter on that too. All right. But it's a memory of something that was misinterpreted, and the child has never been able to make their way through that. And finally, as the person gets into pathways, they finally are able to work through that. And in that chapter, the person actually goes to a spiritual counselor, because the statements were made by a person of the cloth when that case was a young boy.
This focus on non-biomedical approaches that this book takes, and of course, a lot of the work we do takes. As you were talking, it occurred to me, you know, if I had hypertension and I picked up this book, I already know about hypertension. I know I have it. I've probably been prescribed a medication. I've got that level 3 intervention. Mm-hmm. So this is a book that really looks at other aspects, other characteristics of these conditions that are not, quote, medical.
One of my early mentors in the field used to say, skills, not pills. And I'll say to my patients, sometimes it's skills with pills. Mm-hmm. We're not rejecting mainstream medicine, because mainstream medicine has powerful remedies.
Absolutely.
But they're often incomplete, because they don't really address the negative health behaviors, the risky behaviors, as Angel describes them, the lifestyle elements that contribute. If I continue on a salt heavy diet and continue sedentary, taking too much alcohol, then the hypertension medicine doesn't work as much. Dick Gavers used to say, or still says, even though he's an internationally known expert on biofeedback, especially heart rate variability, he will identify the element that makes the biggest difference for his patients is the moment when they begin to think, there's something I can do and it will make a difference. We call that self-efficacy, and that's what we're looking for here. We're looking for experiences that can lead the individual to say to themselves, wow, I did something and I feel 10% better.
The influence of family history, I think, is something you've just referred to, Saul, and that can be used as a positive or as a negative. All right. So the person that is not told what their family history is, then is at a real disadvantage. But how the person processes that information makes a huge difference in whether or not they accept level 3 care. All right, person may reject medicine because they think, well, my father died at this age of a heart attack. My grandfather had a stroke. Now I'm at the age where they started having problems. Therefore, I'm fatalistic. It doesn't make any kind of difference what I do. It's going to get me. And so working through that, several of the chapters make reference to family history, and particularly the hypertension chapter, so that the person has the information. But then the question is, what do you do with that? Do you think, well, there's nothing I can do and they feel more helpless? Or I have this information, that means that there's a lot that I can do now that I know.
That's, I think, where the readiness to change comes into play.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
A lot of times the readiness to change is highly influenced by fear. And the chapter actually on the anxiety disorders talks about fear, which is, you know, at the basis of most of the anxiety disorders. So in a sessions with patients, I will often bring this up as a theme. You know, I say, well, this is frightening. And they say, well, I didn't really think about it like that, you know, that it was really frightening. So I think understanding what's leading to these reactions also is really important. And what they saw as a child, you know, how scared did you see your parents? You know, were they reactive?
As I was reading through the book, I certainly thought about the clients I have who have the different conditions. And when I had that moment, that sort of shift, realizing that they were getting it, you called it self-efficacy. So what is a case that may be a favorite of yours or one that really sticks out in your mind, whether it made it into the book or not?
Well, we probably have lots more cases that we could write. So we had to be really choosy. Well, Don, what was your favorite case?
Well, it's interesting. I think of two different cases. One of them was lupus erythematosus. And I think of that one because making lifestyle changes, engaging in some healthy self-care practices, she actually reached a point where her ANA antibodies tests were normal. And I wasn't promising that. I wasn't expecting that. But lifestyle in her case led to such an improvement medically that her physician said, I think we were wrong. I don't think you had lupus because people with lupus don't improve. Now, so that for me, it shows how powerful lifestyle and behavior change can be. On the other hand, I wrote about a woman with multiple sclerosis, actually not in this book, but in a book with Ina Kazan on mindfulness and biofeedback. And the woman with multiple sclerosis at the end had benefited most from mindfulness, learning mindfulness, learning to accept whatever unfolded for her. And in her case, she said, you know, I don't think my MS symptoms are that different than they ever were. I still have flares or exacerbations when the MS is worse, when I lose some control in my arms, or I have difficulty even standing up, but it doesn't trouble me in the same way. Her motto was observe and accept. That was her mindfulness guideline. And she was able to say to herself, OAA, observe and accept. And on her days that she had very little mobility, she had heavy duty mindfulness, and she actually shared it with her spouse, and he was becoming more accepting. They were actually doing better as a couple because he had felt so helpless, and now he was doing some of the self-care practices with her. So quality of life was helped enormously. And that's a message that I would want to give the patient, that some of the patients following the Pathways model will improve medically, others won't, but the quality of life can be much better.
I think that a couple of my favorite chapters, one that we wanted to include and ended up being one of my favorites, is the chapter on headache, which is actually a chapter on relapse. So again, a person may say, I don't have headaches, so why should I read this? But it's actually about relapse of a chronic condition, which occurs very, very frequently. So the person may reach a healthy place, and then a year later, 5 years later, then the symptoms all return. And they feel devastated by that. And this whole idea of I'm a failure. I had all the high power medical treatments. I went through Pathways. And now look at me, my headaches are back. So I think that's a very important chapter for people to read because it's expected. Relapse of a chronic illness is absolutely going to happen. And it doesn't mean that the medical system has failed, and it doesn't certainly mean that the patient has failed. So they get back into Pathways, and then they identify what led to the relapse, which would be a large number of things, you know, can actually lead to a relapse. And it can be behavioral things, emotional things that then can be managed. And the person then can return to that level of well-being that they had achieved. And probably my second favorite chapter is the chapter on trauma, because that was written about a person, a gentleman who was in the military and had served 20 years and retired from the military and came back home to reenter, you know, normal life and to try to decide what he was going to do for his second career. And he developed symptoms. And symptoms of irritability, symptoms of anxiety, symptoms of depression. And he can't seem to reenter the normal world. And he starts seeking actually medical care. And the physician says, well, you were in the military. So you had traumatic experiences. So that's what's the matter. And he responds to that, it's not that. The branch of the service that he was part of, they had lots of support. And when they came back from a mission, he was a pilot. They came back from a mission, they would have debriefing, then they prepared them for retirement with all sorts of skill-based techniques to prepare them for retirement. And now here he is, he's a mess. So something triggers the memory. And the memory actually comes from a childhood experience, not severe abuse, but a situation where the family had taken in the grandmother with severe dementia. And that grandmother was very, very frightening to the client, to the little boy at the time. And the behaviors were all described in that chapter. And when he came back home, he was spending more time with his mother. And his mother had started to show some signs of forgetfulness. And although that in itself did not trigger it, it took something else. It took a lecture that he attended where the symptoms of dementia were described in detail. And then that triggered the whole memory. And that's actually based on a book that was published about a psychiatric hospital. And it's called I can't remember the name of it, but it was about people in a psychiatric hospital who were allowed to bring one or two suitcases to the psychiatric hospital. And so those suitcases were found in the attic of this hospital when they closed the hospital down. So I saw a play on that and I heard the lecture on that and I purchased that book. And that led to me writing this chapter because I thought, you know, a lot of times you don't know what the trauma is and it's going to emerge in its own time. You can't push it. So once the trauma emerges, then that's a crisis point that requires professional intervention. And then the person in that chapter, then they work their way through it with support from his wife, from his mother, and also from a professional.
So these chronic conditions, they just vary so much. There are characteristics that I think are similar from condition to condition, but even with that variation, whether it's trauma or IBS or headache or MS, this pathways model is still useful. And these are things the two of you have been working with for many, many years. And I'm curious about how the ways your own views about chronic conditions have changed as you've been working with them.
One of the earliest things I learned about holistic approaches to health was a slogan, and I think it came from Norman Shealy, and it was, "People who have something better to do don't get sick as much." Well, that was brought home to me because I did my doctoral dissertation about that time that I learned that slogan. And I worked with 125, mostly women, but men and women, going through intestinal bypass surgery. And the nurses said almost those words. They said, well, the ones who have a job they love and want to get back to don't have nearly the bowel symptoms afterwards or the digestive system symptoms as everybody else. Those people who hate their job or who have nothing going on in their life have many, many more symptoms. And I found that ever since, that one of the things we do is help people not only cope with challenges, but rediscover the sources of joy in their life. Something that they cared about a long time ago that they gave up because of the illness. And is there some way they can restore that interest, maybe in a modified way? Some of my patients have been very athletic, and now they have impaired mobility. Well, I've mentioned the MS patient I did the case narrative about. And in her case, there were times she could not stand up and she could not walk. But what she learned was she still had upper body strength. So she engaged in chair yoga and chair calisthenics, and her upper body became stronger and stronger because the way the multiple sclerosis works, the myelin sheaths of the nervous system deteriorate. And depending on where the deterioration is, different parts of your body may be affected or not affected. And in her case, fortunately, her upper body usually was intact. So that's where she focused.
Well, what I have learned about chronic illness is that the provider has to ask the question, what have you lost as you've developed a worsening chronic illness? And then a lot of what I do is actually grief counseling, because the people who received a diagnosis have lost something. And so this diagnosis, let's say of multiple sclerosis, let's say, what have you lost? Well, I've lost, you know, sometimes I can't get up. And so there's a grief structure there the person may not be aware of, but I think has to be addressed. So we grieve it together, whatever it is. And the person with panic attacks, right? Say, well, so what's been lost there? Well, what's been lost is the sense of stability, not knowing when you're going to have another panic attack and feeling shaky when you go out with meet with people. So you grieve the ease of going out meeting with people because you might have a panic attack. Or the people that have autonomic dysfunction that get dizzy and sometimes are near fainting, near syncope. All right, so you say, well, what have you lost? Well, I've lost a lot. I'm afraid. You know, I'm afraid I'm going to lose my balance. I'm afraid I'm going to fall. I'm afraid I'm going to hurt myself. So I think that grief theme is something I've really learned about chronic illness over the years.
So you've both worked with each other for many years on the pathway model. What was it like to collaborate on this book, which is for the public?
Well, I think I had a lot more fun. I had a lot more fun writing these cases. I mean, they got into my head and I got into their heads and, you know, just carrying that out and writing the thing and bringing in the different levels of the model and say, well, because all these people, by the way, these are all composites of many patients. Okay. And so I would remember a certain person and then I would put some of that person into one of these cases. And then I'm still practicing. So, you know, there kept being, you know, new material coming in as we were writing the book.
I'm going to comment on a couple of contributions that Angel made to this new book. Angel has emphasized healing themes. We know that illness is not just medical. It's not just physical symptoms. It impacts the whole person. We have a strong emotional response to being ill. We experience loss, as Angel was just mentioning. So in each of the case narratives, this time, because of Angel's pointing this out, we highlighted some emotional dimension. The chapter on diabetes, we identified regaining control and making decisions on your health. The chapter on high blood pressure, we emphasized putting heredity into perspective. Genetics is not destiny. Heredity can be placed in perspective. The chapter on cancer, embracing nature and recovering inner peace. The chapter on headache, dealing with difficult relapses and setbacks. So those were all contributions that came from Angel. And then she brought something else to this book, which I wish we had in the other books. Angel teaches in the medical center there, including physicians in training, and she brought some worksheets to this process, and then we developed our own worksheets, one worksheet for each chapter. And I've used those worksheets and other worksheets like them with patients over the years and with people in workshops. And the worksheet, you fill it in about your own experience and things come to mind, which then lead to a different perspective and sometimes to new goals. I wrote the chapter on osteoarthritis, and avoidance behaviors are very common with any kind of chronic illness. You know, if the stove is hot, don't touch it. If it hurts to walk, don't walk. And that's not therapeutic with a chronic condition. It may make sense with acute injuries because we give the muscle tissue time to heal. But with a chronic condition, if you avoid behavior, if you avoid activity, you get further deterioration, deconditioning of the musculature. So confronting avoidances is very important. And my arthritis patient, Margaret, that I wrote the case narrative about, early on had been given some hand exercises, which are very basic to medical therapy and physical therapy for arthritis, and the hand exercises hurt. So she stopped. And when she got to me, we talked about, in her assessment, we talked about avoidance behavior because she was engaging in massive avoidance, hardly any activity at all. And she spontaneously said, I should try those hand exercises again. And that was one of her level one goals, was to resume the hand exercises. And she used the ones that her rheumatologist had given her, but she also used some that she found online from the American Arthritis Association. And she found that she could do most of them. Some of them hurt just too much, and she could gently do a little bit, but others she could do entirely. And that was a recurrent theme for her, because as we got to level two, she did aqua therapy, and she found that in the water, she could do them even bit farther. And the physical therapists involved with aqua therapy assessed her range of motion, and her range of motion was improving. Now, the condition, the inflammatory condition in her joints was still there. We know that. And unfortunately, it will probably continue to progress through her lifetime. But she was able to improve movement. And later on, when we got to level three, she said, I want to do something that will make it hurt less when I do my hand exercises. So she did some acupuncture, and actually the acupuncture was able to reduce her pain when she was doing the hand exercises with some particular meridian sites. So not all of my patients get benefits from acupuncture, but many do. So again, I think it's worth a referral on something like that. But it was interesting to me that overcoming avoidance was just a recurrent theme throughout her entire time. And of course, with anxiety disorders, it's often, I'm nervous driving, so I don't drive. I'm nervous going to the supermarket, I send somebody else to the supermarket. Going back to the supermarket is part of regaining the territory of your life and regaining the sense of confidence in oneself. I can go to the market and get some groceries.
And I think that avoidance theme that's highlighted in that chapter, you know, comes up in other chapters as well. But I think anybody with a chronic illness can pick up that chapter on osteoarthritis. And, you know, not think, well, I don't have that. You know, yes, but you're avoiding because you have panic disorder. You're avoiding because you have trauma. You're avoiding because you have anxiety. You know, and the chapter on the anxiety disorders also relates to that, because the case that's described there, I mean, this woman is terrorized as a child, criticized, treated, you know, very, very badly compared to her brother. And that affects her. She has no self-confidence whatsoever. So that chapter shows how very gradually she can build up some self-confidence. And it leads to a higher level intervention, which is assertiveness. So again, a lot of people with chronic conditions, they feel defeated. You know, they feel defeated. Well, how can I ask for this accommodation? You know, nobody's going to give me an accommodation. You know, they're going to see me as weak. Well, they're presenting themselves as weak. So presenting yourself with assertive behavior and assertive verbiage goes a long way to make a change, not only in how you feel, but also how you are perceived by others.
I think that assertiveness, to me, also goes back to the healthcare system and how many of these patients are dismissed by the healthcare system, which really does a number on that efficacy. And when they go through years of not being believed, or if the treatment's not working, then they pick up on the message that it's their fault, which reinforces all of that negative self-judgment. Do you have any advice for people who are experiencing these chronic conditions to try to maintain that sense of self as best they can?
Are you referring to their interactions with their providers, or just themselves building some level of assertiveness and identity, you mean?
I guess I was thinking particularly within the medical system, but it really is a great general question.
Well, I think we practice assertiveness, and we start with pretty much the lowest level of assertiveness that you can imagine, which would be, you know, going if they're working, going into the office and saying, this is the hottest day of the week. That's the beginnings of assertiveness. And then in other types of conversation, at a restaurant, maybe with people, saying, this is a really good salad. You know, and then sometimes the other people in the group will say, oh, I've never liked that salad. And then say, oh my gosh, no, I like this salad. So that's where we start. And then that can lead up to sentences, practicing sentences. You know, in the old days, I had people write things down on index cards and keep them in their pocket when they were getting ready for a doctor's appointment. Now they have it on their phone, and we practice these sentences together. I'm worried about this medication that you prescribed. Well, are you taking the medication? Yes, I have this side effect. So these things would be written on index cards, and the person would take them to their doctor's appointments. So building assertiveness, building that sense of identity, I like chocolate ice cream. Doesn't sound like much. But, you know, somebody else in the group may say, I'm allergic to chocolate, or I'm lactose intolerant. It's like, oh my gosh, I like chocolate ice cream. So that's where we start.
Well, starting with ice cream is always a good place to start, I think.
I think so, too.
And fortunately, Ben & Jerry's does have some lactate-free ice creams. I've been to Ben & Jerry's.
Yeah.
The concept of illness self-management is a basic one to our approach. And I think introducing that idea for the person is helpful. You're already doing things to manage your illness. There are other things you can probably do to manage your illness that will make just as much difference as anything your physician can do. And if you look at diabetics, they're managing their illness on an everyday basis, and yet they may feel a total lack of control. So I think highlighting it as we do in this approach, small steps that you can take, and then keep referring back to, are you an active agent now? Are you actively doing something about your own illness? And how much difference has it made? Well, it's only made 5% difference so far. Well, if you can do 5%, I bet you can do 20%. I don't have access to it now, but I've seen illness self-management worksheets inquiring of people a variety of different ways that they might actively engage in their own health maintenance. And I think for our next book, we'll have to come up with an illness self-management worksheet to add to the set of worksheets, because that's a gap here.
Are you already planning that next edition? I know this one just came out this year, but...
Yeah, it just came out, yeah.
But we've been talking about it. There have been a couple different ideas. One of them would be to do something on the aging process, a pathway through aging. As our entire population globally ages, it becomes a bigger and bigger challenge. And I think a pathways approach would be valuable. So many of the symptoms that people will say, oh, that's just old age, actually are symptoms of inactivity, sedentary lifestyle. And Jill, you had another idea for a new book.
Well, that's one that relates to our work with medical residents and try to prevent burnout and build resiliency, because we have a program here that we've worked with a number of different residencies at the medical school. So that's something that's kind of floating around the back of my mind.
Well, as we're coming to the end, I wonder if each of you would tell us one thing that everyone living with a chronic condition should know but often doesn't, and then a piece of advice for somebody who's been recently diagnosed.
Okay, well, what they should know, I guess, is that they're certainly not alone, that particularly with this aging population, there's about 85-90% of people that have one chronic illness past that age, and a significant percent that have two or more chronic conditions. So they're certainly not alone. And I think a piece of advice would be, you may feel helpless, but you still have power.
I would add to that, identify one or two small things you can do this week and next week and the following week and try them out. Small steps toward greater health, greater well-being, because the future is now. It begins today.
Well, this is all really great advice, and there's plenty more in this book and the other work you've done. I want to thank you both so much for joining us here on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.
Thank you, Saul, for inviting us and for guiding our discussion.
Yeah, thank you.
You are listening to Healthy Brain, Happy Body. I'm your host, Dr. Saul Rosenthal. Our guides today were Drs. Don Moss and Angel McGrady. Follow the links in the show notes to learn more about their work and their most recent book, Pathways Through Long-Term Health Conditions. Subscribe to this podcast by clicking the Subscribe Here link or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy Healthy Brain, Happy Body, please rate us and leave reviews at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Reviews help us get to more listeners, and that's more people who can learn about and benefit from biofeedback, neurofeedback, and other mind-to-body approaches to health. Also, let us know what you think by sending us email. Our address is healthybrain@nrbs.org. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is produced and edited by me. The theme music is Catch It by Coma Media. It is a production of the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. Go to nrbs.org to find out more about the organization, including our trainings, monthly webinars, and yearly conference. This year, NRBS will gather in New York City from October 24th to the 26th. Be sure to join us. All opinions expressed on Healthy Brain, Happy Body are those of our guests and not the NRBS. This podcast is not meant to replace advice from qualified healthcare providers. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is supported by the sponsors of NRBS and by the International Society for Neuroregulation and Research. Be sure to join us on our next episode as we continue to explore the keys to our well-being on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.